Ladies and gentlemen, in the blue corner, standing at a sleek 5'11", 245 pounds, the tumultuous tempest of technique, Thomas Lilly. And in the red corner, at a curvaceous 5'11", 315 pounds, the jovial juggernaut of judgment, John Cheryl Sheridan. A meeting of the masters of mastication. Turn your attention as they delve deep into all things lifting and more. This is Peak Speak.
All right, welcome back to another episode of Peak Speak. Joining me always is Mr. John Sheridan. Say hi.
Hi. I don't know if the microphone can hear me, but I'm not where they are.
So we're going to superimpose John into this. And today we have a very special guest, Dr. Quinn Hennick. Is that how I say your name?
Yeah, that's good.
All right, good, good, good.
Nailed it.
Yeah, I've been doing my research and listening to podcasts to make sure I get it right. So Dr. Quinn Hennick operates as a doctor of physiotherapy out of here, which is SoCal Strength.
SoCal Weightlifting.
SoCal Weightlifting, okay. Dr. Hennick, can you give us a bit of an introduction? Can you tell us a little bit more about who you are, the kind of people that you work with, your background?
Yeah, so we're sitting in my office right now. So I have this space, and then right outside we have a barbell gym, weightlifting, powerlifting, CrossFit-esque type training. And so that's the majority of my current clientele. I went to college to be a strength conditioning coach and did that for a while and just wanted to kind of, I guess, increase the breadth of knowledge in regards to managing injuries and rehab, and took that back to physical therapy school, graduated in 2013 from PT school, and within that started my competitive weightlifting career. So I've kind of been trying to blend those worlds and played American football in undergrad university. So it's just kind of like this setting is the dream for me. It's what I wanted to do. You know, my clientele is 99.9%. athletes, as I define athlete, is just somebody walks in the door with goals of getting back to athletic endeavors. Whether or not they're any good at those things is another story. But you know, that's my right. That's who I work with, and it's just a lot of fun.
Just gonna bring you back to the potty, Joe.
Yeah, I'm not gonna lie. It would have been real awkward if I just had to stare at an empty wall and a camera all the time.
All right, that's really cool. So for the Australian viewers, which will probably be everyone. Just to clarify, when you say PT, you're talking about physical therapy, which for us is
physio. Synonymous. Yeah. I think we're the only country that calls it physical therapy. Everybody else calls it physio.
Yeah.
Classic physio. America.
when Australians hear the word PT, they're going to think
personal trainer. Yeah. Okay.
So
I got you. It's like that here. So the only distinction is written.
Okay.
PT in all caps is physical therapist.
Okay.
But if you say it, you have no clue whether you're talking about a trainer or a therapist.
Yeah, good. And can you tell us a little bit more about what you do at Clinical Athlete? Because I think both John and I agree that what you put together there is really, really cool.
Yeah.
Definitely.
So Clinical Athlete is a network. It's a network of healthcare providers of various disciplines. It's a network of coaches. And at base level, it's a directory. So athletes can go on clinicalathlete.com and find a provider who has gone through a vetting process. So we have applications for these people. We put them into a private forum that we have. And so they're required to actually discuss ideas. And then, so it's probably a month-long process. And then I have a phone conference, email conference with those people, and then they're on the directory. So if an athlete goes and finds somebody in their area, they can kind of trust that they're going to have a better understanding of integrating athletic performance and rehab. And so that's the big deal. And we have continuing education courses and these types of things. So it's really, it's an educational platform for the professional, and then it's a trusted source for the athlete.
Yeah, excellent. Excellent. So I think that kind of segues into the question that that John had raised a little earlier. So do you want to talk about what you were saying before?
Yeah, so I am interested to hear your views on like the role of a therapist in getting someone back to their athletic endeavors, whatever that may be. I have seen enough therapists in my life to know that there's a lot of therapists who are far more interested in just seeing you every week than they are in actually getting you back to doing what you do. And I know the therapists that I've talked to that I consider to be, you know, the best at what they do are the ones who only want to see you a couple of times, give you the tools you need, and then get you back to whatever it is you want to do. So yeah, mostly I'd just be interested to hear your thoughts on that front.
This is huge. This is a huge question. It's basing the question itself is basically how I've based my model. So you are, it's like that here in the States too. It's kind of like, all right, you come in with knee pain, and it's almost assumed. It's like, all right, I'll see you two times a week for the next 6 weeks. And yeah, it's almost a cookie cutter thing. Yeah. And from a business perspective, there's a whole lot of things that can go into it, as in, like, I have these magic hands that can fix you, but they're only going to be able to fix you if you come in twice a week for the next 6 weeks. Sign on the dotted line, these types of things. And insurance models here in the States lend themselves to those types of plans. It's a problem because the care is not individualized. The incentive is based on the bottom line of the practitioner, to be completely honest. And for me, that's why I practice the way that I do. So I'm going to speak for me and what we do here that kind of counteracts that exact problem, because I completely agree with you. My model here is completely out of pocket, out of network. We don't deal with insurance companies, because then that puts the onus on the individual, the athlete, who now has to invest in their own care, essentially. I see myself as a consultant, as a guiding light, and then the most important person in the room is the athlete, number one, and then number two is the strength and conditioning coach. So my model is such that the athlete walks in, we're gonna work on managing behavior and modifying stressors, and then they're going to walk out with a plan to put into action probably for about a month. I'm going to be there to correspond, but that doesn't include them being here with me.
Yeah.
So it's much more of a hands-off, low frequency, me integrating their coach into the fold and getting the athlete to essentially manage their own case, because ultimately that's the only way that we're going to see progress. That model is not great for business. The frequency is extremely low.
Yeah.
And, you know, with the insurance, the disadvantage of having a cash-based model is that I could very easily become a salesman, because now I'm like trying to incentivize you coming back and these types of things. But my whole philosophy is that the training stress, managing training load, is the rehab.
Yeah.
So I mean, that's honestly why we do all these other things like clinical athlete, and we do education courses, because if I only relied on my in-person visits to keep the lights on, we actually wouldn't have lights and we wouldn't have this office, because I wouldn't be able to afford it. I'd have a better career. I think though that if we can figure out, like I tell the coaches here, we're very close. We meet all the time. I see the new athletes that come into the gym. They are required to see me for a consultation, and it's not on their dollar. So it's integrated system of the gym. And we just talk about their injury history, basically giving me a background so that we kind of, if something does go wrong, I have baseline information that we can go off of. I'm so much more interested in creating training systems that reduce injury risk based on how they're programming the exercise.
And for sure.
Load. And then teaching the coaches how to manage the common injuries that come on. And it's like the majority of cases are, hey, my knee hurts when I squat 150 kilos. It's like, okay, you don't need me to tell you to go a little bit lighter for a week. You know,
some people aren't very smart.
Right. So if I can ingrain that into the coach and say, okay, first priority, is it intensity driven? You know, okay, lower the dose, you know, or lower the volume, or tweak this movement, do this variation instead.
Yeah.
We can screen a lot of those things that they don't have to come and see me. You know, I should be an adjunct. I'm telling the athletes here, I'm here if you need me, but you probably won't, because the coaches are frontline defenders and I'm in contact with them all the time.
Yeah.
So the challenge though
And from a business perspective, the challenge is making that monetary. And I think some individuals see it, they see these worlds as separate, as the only way they can build a business.
Yeah.
This is, they need to see me, you know, a certain, I can do something different than the coaches here or than their training program. I bring something different to the table. And, you know, we may get into the stuff, but the reality of treatment, physio treatment, is largely short-term, symptom-based, perceptual-based, placebo-based approaches that if you spin them a certain way with your words, can create clients.
Yeah.
If you're prioritizing the athlete, you are trying to make them autonomous. You're trying to put the onus on them. And then again, I'm a guiding light, but the coaches are more of an important guiding light because they see them every day and they're writing the programs.
Yeah.
So that's how I model the care here. It's very much the opposite of what you described and what I see a lot with the high frequency, I'll fix you type of thing, you know, keep the lights on. It's much more of a hands-off consulting approach.
Yeah. And I think, that's, it sort of rings true with me for like my approach to coaching as well. Not that I don't want to write people's programs and things like that, but my goal is to teach people, not to like have to hold their hand through the whole process, and give them the tools they need to assess their own movement and understand that. And there are some people who are just unwilling to do that. And I think that's where those people don't stay around. They tend to go to someone who's more willing to hold their hand and, you know, cheerlead them through the whole process.
And that's fine, right? And like, if we have these conversations with an athlete, they know, I think that I do a decent job at creating expectations before they even walk in the door. So if an athlete's going to come to see me, I have a series of questions that I screen them with. And also in the information of like the details of my consultations, I kind of give a pretty clear picture of what to expect and what not to expect.
Yeah.
Like, you're not going to just lay on the table and get these magic hands for half an hour. It's just not what you're going to get. And so I probably filter a lot of people out right from the very beginning. But if that's what they want and then they insist, you're just like, you know what, I want this specific passive modality. I need that. I want that or whatever. Then I'm like, that's totally fine. I know two practitioners down the road that do that. Go see them, name, number, email. If things don't clear up, if you're having issues, I'm here if you need me, that type of thing. And I said, it's kind of what you're saying is like, not everybody's the right fit for everybody.
Yeah, exactly.
And they may come back too. Like, you know, they may see the light or whatever, or however we want to describe that, and say, yeah, you know what? I want to try what you got going on 6 months down the line, or you may never hear from them again. But for me, for my mental state, that's a much more sustainable model, because you end up working with the people that you want to work with. They work with the person that they want to work with. And it, you know, we enjoy our lives.
Yeah. It's such a double-edged sword because, you know, you're putting so much more value into your service, but that value is also, you know, disruptive to your business in the sense that you're not getting people in 3, 4, 5 times a week for 6 weeks.
And sometimes the perceived value of the client or athlete is a little different than what I perceive my value to be, you know, and so that can be frustrating because you feel as a coach or like as me as a clinician, I feel that I have a good idea of what will get them going in the long term to reach their goals. And maybe there's that perceptual barrier and we're not quite seeing eye to eye. And sometimes it's better to just kind of like put a pause on it. And then again, if they want to revisit the conversation, they can. But I think that it's for anybody, it's really, really important to nail down your values and not to just say yes to everything and to everybody. And when you do that, you start to have some turnover. It's tougher in the beginning because not, you know, have this line coming out the door of people,
yeah.
You know, you start to panic a little bit.
Yeah, for sure.
Yeah. But what you find though, over the course of months is that you start to build a little tribe.
Mm.
Those people start telling other people and there's enough people out there for everyone. You start getting people. And for me, injuries happen. I know that's just a part of the deal. So, you know, if I manage somebody's ankle sprain or knee injury and I see them once or twice and they get better, like sending my business out the door, I know number one, they're going to appreciate the honesty and they're probably going to tell people. Number two, I'm probably going to see them again in 8 to 10 months or like a year down the line when it's like, now it's the shoulder or something like that. But you start to see that revolving door in a good way.
Yeah. Yeah.
Not losing people.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. And I think that's like you essentially said everything that I thought you would say.
Oh, that's not fun.
Well, not in a bad way, in that I had a suspicion that was your view. I always like to tell people that, you know, like with a lot of the physio stuff and these, like you said, those passive modalities, you know, and I'm sure I've heard you say it before, like none of them are going to be as effective as the things you do to yourself and being able to correct your own movement and do it through movement rather than just lying on a table while someone stabs you in the ass with needles or whatever it happens to be.
Well, and there's common sense with this too. Like I mentioned that my model is about managing stressors. And for me, my clients, for you guys too, the biggest stressor that we're talking about is the stressor of the weight of the train, you know, or whatever. And it's modifying behavior. But why would, if somebody comes with very specific complaints, my hip hurts when I do this activity, why would I then not directly go after modifying that activity in some way and then kind of reshaping beliefs and expectations and modifying behavior specific to the stressor that's causing their issue, as opposed to going down the rabbit hole of some minutia and doing something passively that's so non-specific to the stressor that's causing the issue? It seems like we're ignoring just common sense, you know?
Yeah, I think you've hit the nail on the head in terms of what's missing in this whole model of coach, athlete, therapist, is the connection between all three.
Yeah.
You're in a very unique position in that you do weightlifting, you understand the other lifts, you understand powerlifting, you're surrounded by these kinds of people, and you've got that connection with coaches. I think that's pretty rare in this whole scene, even worldwide, is that there's such a disconnect between coach, therapist, to when an athlete does get hurt, it's like they've got two things in their ear, there's no connection, and nothing really happens. Well, or, like you say, the treatment is so far removed from the actual activity.
Well, I think sometimes, number one, we forget the most important person in the room is the athlete. Like, I think that some of these treatments are more of ego padding for the clinician, to be honest. You know, it's like, I got that patient better. Like, it feels good. It's like, oh, me, you know, don't
I fix them.
They feel better because of me,
yeah. Right?
Me instead of them. And then number two, it comes down to education. This is a big thing with clinical athlete, is that we need a curriculum change. Because in physio school, this barbell was not a part of the deal. Like in our therapeutic exercise classes, a very small percentage of what we were taught anyway, anything beyond, you know, the Mount Rushmore of physio exercises, glute bridge, clamshell, bird dog, side plank, front plank, anything beyond that was just not taught at all because they don't know that, you know, that's not the deal. So then what happens is you graduate from physio school and just because the company that you work for calls themselves sports med or physio, then you're deemed a sports therapist, but you have no knowledge. You've not been trained in that. I do, like, my lens is biased because I was a coach leading up. Like, that's what I wanted to do, and I did it even during school. So to me, that seemed normal. But you're right. There's a disconnect because that's not part of the education. And so you have this riff, and who's caught in the middle? The most important person in the room is the athlete.
Mm. Yeah, and I think part of that rift has come from it's something that I think is probably slowly changing now, but for a very long time, you know, the coach in the gym was a person who was dismissed by therapists because, you know, maybe like I'm halfway through an exercise physiology and clinical rehab degree that I'm not studying at the moment because I just don't have the time. But I can see how plenty of people, especially if they don't know my history in terms of athletics and coaching and stuff, would look at me on paper and go, well, this guy's got no real qualifications and therefore his opinion doesn't matter, or I'm not going to talk to him because he's not on my level and things like that. It's like, well, I can sit down with just about most physios I've ever met and have a really in-depth conversation about lifting, about coaching and that sort of stuff, because I've been doing it for so long and I have that experience. But I think it's slowly changing through people like yourself, where you can see that actually the role of the coach is really quite important, because like you said, they're the one that impart those stresses upon the athlete. And if you're, as a therapist, I would imagine if you're completely ignoring that as a portion and just focusing on you and the athlete, you're missing that piece that is actually going to be the thing that stops them coming back to you in the long term.
Exactly. And I, again, where my setting is ideal for what we're talking about.
Yep.
And so I understand that, but that doesn't mean that communication can't be there. Like just because somebody else's office isn't inside the gym doesn't mean that they can't then pick up the phone or write an email to the coach right after they see the athlete and there's that communication. And I think if you were a fly on the wall and didn't know that I had a doctorate in physical therapy and you were just watching me interact with my patients, you would be like, that dude, he's just a strength coach.
Yeah.
And so like yesterday, for example, we have a new member and he's new to snatching and clean and jerking. He's having a little shoulder issue. And we talked a little bit in here, and then we went out and we did snatches and clean and jerks, and that was a physical therapy session.
Mm.
That was therapy. And we modified stressors, we modified his positioning to redistribute load, we tweaked kind of his, again, movement, these types of things, but we talked about mostly about loading parameters, and then we kind of dived into his triggers, because he wasn't having his issues with the empty bar, he was having his issues at heavier loads or higher volumes when fatigue was a factor. And so educating him that you need to recognize your own thresholds so that you can kind of self-select these things. And then after our session, immediately coach is on the floor who writes his program. I'm having a conversation with the coach, relaying these things. And now programming can be tweaked. Eyes can be, we're all on the same team.
Mm.
That is an ideal situation.
Without a doubt.
It is not, I think, as ideal as we can make it, it's not necessarily the most efficient from a time perspective. If your model is, got to be patient in, patient out, my bottom line is based on how many people I see coming in the door. So then you have to build some infrastructure that, in agreements with different facilities, like, look, I can maybe reduce injury risk. Let's start tracking. Let's have the athletes start reporting how many days missed of training due to injury. And let's see if we can put together programs and systems that reduce those data points. And then maybe some type of monetary agreement can be made between the clinician and coach. Like, you can spin it like that.
Yeah.
Universities have these things that PTs on salary. Like, if I came into a facility like this and it was a school, I would be on salary and have no problem in, communicating these types of things. So I know I'm getting paid for my time.
Yeah.
The issue is like all that extra stuff that I just describe, like consulting with the coaches, those aren't necessarily paid hours.
Yeah.
If you're not proactive about building those systems. So it's just a different paradigm.
Yeah, for sure.
But I think we just need more people doing it.
Yeah.
Then we'll start to figure out, how to make it.
Oh, yeah, for sure, man. Like you said, I think, as a gym owner, my ideal situation is to have a gym where I can have a therapist like you who works full-time out of my gym and can see every athlete that comes through my door, because that's the way that you're going to get the long-term progress out of it. And in the end, I think a lot of people forget that what we do is based on the people we help. It's, I didn't get into coaching and owning a gym to make a shitload of money. Because if I did, I wouldn't own a powerlifting gym. I'd own a fucking Anytime Fitness and never see 80% of my members. But you're right. I think it's a different paradigm, and I'd love to see the whole industry go that way. But I think it's definitely going to be a slow shift.
As an example, at our gym, we've pretty much done exactly that. One of the guys that trains there, he trained through school, became a physiotherapist, and now he treats all our guys. And the health of the average lifter has changed dramatically just because we've communicated so openly and on the gym floor and worked together on lifters. And it does. It makes a huge impact on performance. And again, it comes back to the lifters are the most important part of this puzzle.
Mm.
I think we'll move on to some questions, just because we could talk about this all day.
Yeah, 100%. Yeah.
All three of us are very passionate on this subject, and
Jen and I will milk you for all your left uncapped. So I think we'll start this question. A common thing that happens, especially, well, almost exclusively in female lifting, is a loss of control of bladder function while they're lifting. So being on the platform. John and I run meets. We both run a lot of meets. Happens all the time. Happens at every meet. We know it's not a big deal. It happens. My question is this a symptom of something bigger? Like the peeing is as a result of something? Is it a case of poor bracing technique? Can it be fixed? Can it be improved? Because, you know, while we say to everyone, it's not a big deal. If it happens on the platform, it happens.
Yeah.
For a lot of women, when it does happen, they freak out. They stop pushing. They miss a lift. That can cost them the competition. You know, is there something bigger going on under the surface?
Yeah. So I'll preface it by saying I am not a pelvic health therapist, and this is not my specialty. But having said that, there is not a whole lot of data on lifters, and stress incontinence is really what we're talking about here. The pressure causing that to happen, as opposed to some other type of medical condition that's just beyond this, right? But some of it's contextual, so you'll see it more often with women who are post-pregnancy.
Mm.
And so just kind of a change in the muscle tone, for lack of a better word, it's harder to find that word, but just kind of reacclimating to their body, going through these changes and learning how to use those muscles again that have literally been stretched over the course of many months. So that's a thing. There's some adaptive changes that happen during pregnancy that you kind of have to retrain. But I think we can simplify this a little bit and say that let's make the stress incontinence when it happens. Let's think about thresholds in the same way that we would think about a threshold of just simply not being able to lift the weight or causing some type of movement change to happen at a certain stressor, at a certain volume of weight or whatever. So with women that this happens to, what you'll find is that there is a threshold of intensity at which it happens. It usually doesn't just happen with the empty bar, right? It doesn't usually just happen with lighter loads. At some level, there's enough pressure that's caused, literally pushing out, right? So as a coach, I'm ignoring like bracing strategies right now. So what we can just simply find is like, where is that threshold? At what percentage of intensity or exertion level does that generally happen? Usually there's a pattern. And then we can say, just like training any other quality or any other muscle group, let's get most of our work just below that threshold. And what you'll find is those thresholds tend to rise. And it's kind of up and down. Like let's say somebody is consistently has stress incontinence at 90% and above of their max deadlift or squat or whatever. If you get most of your work, let's say tempo work or pause work, below that threshold, and then start to just touch that threshold a little bit over time, what you'll find is now at 90%, it only happens 50% of the time when it was 100% of the time. And at 90, now it's 93% of their threshold that it happens 100% of the time. But you start to see change there because the pelvic floor musculature can be, it's a muscle group like anything else. It can be trained.
Mm-hmm.
The thing is the pelvic floor is more of an autonomic muscle group, as in it should be reflexive. Like when you create pressure and when your body is loaded, your pelvic floor, just like your diaphragm, your respiratory diaphragm, should just kind of come online automatically. Like it undulates its intensity of contraction based on the stress. So it should happen automatically. So what we can do consciously is modulate the stressor. For non-athletes, it's like the Kegel exercises are kind of the gold standard right now. It's like consciously hold in your pee. Or close your holes is a common cue that specialists will use. The issue, though, is that you're using that muscle group now as like your bicep, where it becomes a conscious contraction. And we all know that if you're deadlifting 90% and above or squatting 90% and above, we're not volitionally contracting any muscle. We're just assuming all the muscles are online and we're hoping not to die.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So we have to control the stressor first and foremost. Now, over the top, you can cue. It's like, okay, just under that threshold, but I want you also to use the cue of close your holes, tighten up. And that, so you're using that the whole Kegel exercise approach in conjunction with consciously modifying the dose. So you're hoping that your body has some volitional control, some autonomic control, which it does if we're just talking stress incontinence, if there's some type of nerve damage that's beyond this. But that's in place, and then you're bringing in the conscious contraction, because you can still consciously contract those muscles. So if you use that, then maybe the expectation is that, okay, you know, on the platform, this may continue to happen for a little bit, but you're going to start to see that threshold window close a little bit. And I think that's the most simplistic way to manage it, is to really hone in on when it happens, at what dosage, and then modify the dosage consistently, 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 just like any muscle group that you would want to train. As far as optimal or suboptimal bracing strategies, it's tough, because I've seen it. I've seen cues work and positions work both ways. So like pelvic tilt, for example, if a lot of athletes, if they hyperextend, they have less ability to kind of to do the close, the whole cue. They have less ability to kind of pull their pelvic floor and tighten things up if they're hyperextended. But I've also seen the same if I'm cueing like, okay, I actually want you to tuck your tailbone a little bit. I want you to stay a little bit more neutral. And I've seen it like that is the cue that actually makes things just gives them a better flow.
Yeah.
So to be honest, I self-select position. So like pelvic tilt in a squat in regards to stress incontinence, I let the athlete kind of self-select where they feel like they can create the strongest volitional contraction of the pelvic floor. As far as breathing and bracing, well, if we're thinking about it, technically, if you create more pressure, that's going to create more force down. It's actually maybe would increase stress incontinence. So again, self-selecting the intensity of the contraction of the pressurized system. On a max effort deadlift, for a performance perspective, you have to create the most tension. So it just may happen. If we're just ignoring the whole like training threshold and we're just saying, oh, you got to brace as hard as you possibly can. And then if we say, well, just don't brace as hard, well, you might not be able to lift as much. So that's why I'm kind of, it's more of a gray area for me to say that it's a poor or suboptimal bracing strategy or position, because I don't think we have a good feel on what is optimal. And I think it's variable depending on the person, if that makes sense.
Yeah, definitely.
No, I do think, I think from a starting point, this is not even stress incontinence, this is just like performance in general. Let's say we're wearing a weightlifting belt. We want to create 360 degrees of pressure or tension. So if like, imagine you're wearing a weightlifting belt, you want to feel yourself, your torso is pushing against the belt in all directions. I think that's a great place to start. So as opposed to just pooching your belly to the front of the belt, which kind of throws, think of a soda can. You know, you want pressure all the way around. So I think that's a great place to start. And then from a pelvic tilt standpoint and an intensity of brace standpoint, those things can be self-selected and modulated to find a balance. But that doesn't trump. Those are like second tier principles. Finding your threshold at which it happens is first priority, first tier, and you get most of your training there. And then again, over time, I think the system starts to adapt. And you start to see a break in the cycle. Like the athlete will say, you know what, I didn't pee this time. This is the way that usually makes me pee, and this time I didn't.
Yeah.
But you know, and that's a break in the cycle, and that's a victory. And then the next time she hits that weight, maybe it happens again. But it didn't happen. Like that was a change. You know what I mean? And so I think that's probably the best I have as far as addressing those things. And I think the biggest thing is reassurance, education. And I think reassurance is like, this is the way that we're going to manage it. And you explain, like, we're going to train this exactly the way that we train everything else. Like, you say, well, I want to be strong enough to squat this amount of weight. Well, we got to train that. We got to train the lower weights and build volume and capacity there. And then slowly we'll work up. It's the exact same quality.
I think one of the things about that as well is often it happens to – in my experience, it happens to women who have often not done a lot of real high intensity physical exertion at some point, especially in a, from a powerlifting perspective. Like, I get a lot of people who, men and women, who maybe haven't done anything athletic in a decade or more. And so then when you suddenly put them in a position where they're exerting themselves on a max effort lift, and it happens, and they go, oh shit, I wasn't expecting that. I didn't see that coming, and it catches them by surprise. And like Thomas said, that's where they miss lifts. That's where it potentially puts, you know, a competition on the line. I think just talking about it as a more common thing, like, it, you know, it's probably not a good thing, but it's definitely common, and it's something that a lot of women experience. And like you said, it's an education thing. We can train you out of it. It's just going to take time and a concerted effort.
And what, and the example that you just gave is a preparation thing. It's like, it goes back to training anything else. If you are not used to or prepared to hit these types of stressors or intensities, things can happen. And I, you know, structurally with women, they have a shorter urethra. Like, they have less buffer. Dudes are, you know, it's just different. So it's like different anatomy. Maybe, you know, I don't know if they've done studies where men can just create more pressure in the muscles that are supposed to kind of cut that off. Like, I don't know. But I think that if you spin it where it's like anything else, again, if you wanted to lift this weight and you hadn't prepared to lift it and you couldn't lift it, you wouldn't be like, well, I don't know why I can lift, I don't know why I can't lift this weight. You know, it wouldn't be a question. You would like accept that as a process.
Yeah.
And it's, if you spin it that way, I think it's much more of an accepting process. It's still like, I get, like, it's an embarrassing thing, and it's a lot of, like, especially women to male coaches may not be something that they want to talk about. But I think that if you're able to kind of slowly, you know, work these conversations in, they get more comfortable about talking about it, and even that alone can create a huge shift in mindset. And then they'll have, it'll be more buy-in to what you're saying as a male coach.
Yeah, because I've had female lifters who've, like, had it happen, or, like, almost had it happen, and then, like, not wanted to tell me. And then when I've, like, broached the subject with them, like, clearly uncomfortable talking about it. And they say, look, if this is what happened, this is super common, and you're certainly not the first woman that I've had that happen to. And so I think, especially when it's those people who aren't exposed to that, like, you know, we live in a somewhat insular world where, like, all of my female athletes talk to each other. Like, they've all got a, like, group message where they can all talk about these things. And then it's like, oh, okay, it really is something that is quite common. And it's, you know, maybe it's not normal, but it's definitely common. And just getting that word out, I think, is definitely going to be a proactive step towards helping people solve the problem.
And we've had world level lifters that, and that's like a regular thing, like heavy cleaning jerks, you know, world level female athletes, like, it happens. But I've seen, because we kind of dive into their training history, and it's like, they were just going heavy all the time. And there was never really a prolonged period of time, a months of blocks of training where they actually lifted at sub threshold loads, to where their body could finally acclimate to the stressor and be okay. Like, they weren't always just blasting through the threshold that would cause it to happen. Then I've seen over the course of then 2 or 3 years where there's a drastic change in the frequency that it happens, the duration, the amount, you know, all of these things start to change. But you've got to kind of put a concerted effort into biting the ego a little bit, maybe being down a little, spending more time, you know, honing in on the positions. And it's tedious too. It's like anything else.
Yeah.
Like, consciously thinking about that control and lifting it at sub-maximal loads, maybe a little bit more frequently or longer than you want to. And again, that's kind of on us as the coaches to just kind of reassure, keep reassuring, buy in.
Yeah, for sure.
Awesome. I think that that answered it perfectly. And I think the important thing to take away from that is that it's workable. You can improve it. Yeah, cool. Let's move on to the next question that John and I had. And I think we'll jump into the stability stuff. So, you know, it seems to be, I don't know if buzzword is the right word to use here, but people are talking about it a lot more. I think inherently both John and I incorporate a lot of stability work into our coaching styles.
I guess we want to hear a little bit more about the importance of stability work. Can you tell the people what stability actually is? Because I think getting the definition right can help you use this language correctly and then start to approach your training in the right way.
Well, that's the defining is the first step in anything, because that's going to create the paradigm. Like, what are we actually talking about here? Stability is a buzzword. It's thrown around all the time. It's actually defined in the literature, though, as opposed to a word, its counterpart, mobility, which is probably the most popular buzzword. There is no definition for that. So if you ask me what it is, I have no freaking clue. Stability is defined typically as the ability to resist a stress and stay at a baseline. Or the word perturbation is thrown out a lot. You'll see stability defined as the ability to resist a perturbation. That could be statically. So if you're trying to hold a position, I can resist the perturbations of gravity, of the barbell, whatever implement you're using to stay in that desired position. Or it could be dynamic stability. I'm attempting to move through a desired path, and I'm resisting the perturbations that are being imposed upon me. Another way to define it is, if I am knocked off course, stability is defined as my ability to then bring it back on track and come back to equilibrium. Or so a stable system is how well I can maintain equilibrium, essentially. So from a movement perspective, it's how well I can hold a certain position or move through a desired path, resisting these forces. So I don't necessarily see stability work as anything different than normal training. A back squat is stability work. Can you move through the desired path? If the amount of load is such that it's too heavy for you to move through the path the way that we want as a coach, we can say, well, you were strong enough to produce the force. Strength is just force production. So you were strong enough to move the weight from point A to point B, but not in the position that we were cueing or that we would think is optimal for performance. So in that sense, maybe you were not stable enough to move the weight from point A to point B. So it's kind of a semantics thing between stability and strength. But for me, it's a much closer relationship than I think is narrated more often, which is like stability work is its own completely separate category. And it's usually
how many Bozo balls do you need to stand on in order to squat heavy?
Yeah. So you're measuring stability with non-specific lower level exercises that are probably not stressful enough to create any type of adaptation. So it's like a stability exercise becomes its own category. And I think it's more of an inherent quality that's in any movement whatsoever. Now I still use lower level drills. Like I have an entire book on that shit, but there, for me, it's about teaching. It's about creating some type of motor pattern or control within a system, because the athlete is not, their prowess is not yet developed enough to accomplish the task in a more complex pattern. So like, let's take the barbell snatch, more of a complex movement pattern than say a half kneeling overhead press. So if we start at the snatch and they're simply unable to move through the pattern that we deemed optimal for performance, maybe we break that down. But to me, the next tier down is maybe we're doing like a snatch balance. That's still a stability exercise. We can manipulate variables like load, tempo, volume, these types of range of motion. So all of those things for them to be able to learn to move through the desired path, which we can define as stability. Mm-hmm. We then can layer on stress as in the form of load or speed or increased range of motion to build capacity. But the goal is that the system stays stable even when you throw those increased stressors on top. And if it doesn't, then you take a stressor away and give them that break. But it's kind of just an inherent concept within normal training. At least that's how I frame it, because it makes it more simple for me. It's not a compartmentalized
thing. No, that's perfect. So it's like looking at it like a pyramid, right? So at the top you have the movement. So the quality of that movement is most important. Like you say, if you can't achieve that, then we go to like a secondary movement or an iteration of that initial movement to learn that quality and add it in as it breaks down.
So yeah, exactly. So like a bird dog, for example, may be a stability exercise. Like I don't usually, but like, let's say I'm using a bird dog because
the athlete has not been able to move through the desired path and all of these higher level functions. And we've had to just break it all the way down to say, you know what, this is your hip. This is how you extend your hip. And the bird dog position is just a nice way for them to feel what it's like to extend their hip. It's a teaching tool. It is not in and of itself the magic ticket to creating some quality that's then all of a sudden going to translate into a heavier deadlift. It's just an adjunct movement. It's like you feel that, you feel like you're moving through your hip. Cool. We're going to now take that into a hip hinge drill. We're going to take that back into the deadlift to integrate that quality.
Instead of just going from a deadlift and going, oh, you're not stable enough here, you can only do bird dogs, and now we've got to, like, you're missing that piece in the middle. Like Thomas said, the pyramid idea where we're stepping it down instead of just going from, you know, gold standard deadlifts to, oh, you've got to lie on the floor and kick your legs around a little bit, and missing that piece in the middle, which is really important.
100%. It's like a top-down approach versus a bottom-up approach. If they can't do the complex pattern at the very, very top, that doesn't necessarily mean that the protocol requires them to go all the way to the bottom and work that bottom thing for that's the only thing they can do, and somehow that's going to fill the gap in the middle. That's just typically not the way it works. And that's the problem with certain protocols, like, oh, they can't deadlift. They need bird dog, side plank, and single leg deadlift. This is the protocol now because it's all non-specific. Our body, specificity is king. 100% no matter what.
And you watch people get really good at that stuff and the quality of movement doesn't change.
There's no carryover, exactly. But if you frame it, if you don't compartmentalize it and you frame it with context, it does have more of a benefit. So like, well, I'm just going to go back to the bird dog example. If we just break it down and say, okay, you feel your hip extending, in that moment we take it immediately back into a higher level strategy to try to incorporate that motor control, it'll click, it'll have much more context, it'll resonate with them much more. Now you are developing stability within a pattern, but it's not the bird dog was just what I chose. That's not the exercise that's creating the thing. That's just a piece that's teaching them to create the quality, if that makes sense. And I keep saying bird dog. There's a million different lower level exercises and drills that you could do for that type of concept.
Definitely. Good.
I think that was an excellent answer. That that covered it all really nicely. Yeah. I still think you should definitely start StabilityWad.com though.
StabilityWad. I'm pretty sure there's a StabilityWad Instagram.
That's disappointing.
That I just gave them, you know, they're getting exposure right now.
I reckon he does.
Yeah, that's perfect.
Yeah, like Thomas's frustrated strength coach.
Yeah, whatever. All right, we have just over 5 minutes. John, do you have a burning question you want to ask, or are we going to divert to one of the ones on the list?
I don't think so. Let's just go back to what we had on the list.
Okay.
I can't think of anything that's come up that. Yeah.
Right after we stop recording, you're gonna be like, ah,
yeah.
Oh yeah, exactly. That's always how it happens.
Exactly. I think we'll tackle one really quickly, as quickly as you can put it into 5 minutes. Probably the most common thing. John and I work not exclusively, but the majority of our work is with powerlifters. The number one thing that comes up in my coaching, anyway, as an ailment is arm pain from squatting. So can you give us your thoughts around where it's coming from and how to address it?
Like forearm?
Yeah, I mean, people experience bicep pain in their arm.
Yeah, for sure. Yeah. Okay, so, and
they experience it almost exclusively when they bench press, never when they squat.
Never when they squat, not squatting.
Well, sometimes squatting. Okay. It comes from low bar squatting.
I got you, okay. So I see it with squatting a lot because of the position of the low bar. It just inherently puts that elbow into a little bit more valgus. Like, so it's stressing some of that connective tissue. With the bench, I see it as much more of a training load thing. So this is not going to be just a arm conversation. This is going to be, we could probably throw every non-traumatic injury into this bucket of training load beyond tissue's capacity. So you can ask these people simple questions like, do you think that if you did the empty bar for all of your workouts that you would feel this exact pain? And they'll be like, no, that's stupid. It's only when I go like heavy. It's only when I'm training. You know, okay. So then there is some threshold
where the training stress is beyond the tissue's ability to cope, and now your body is singing to you a little bit. It's throwing out warning signs. So it's much less important what tissue we're talking about. It's probably a combination of muscle sensitivity and ligaments and tendons and all these things. But if we can simplify it by saying, you may need to just dial back your training load, or maybe you progress too soon. There's so much data coming out right now showing that spikes in training load can increase your risk of these types of injuries, exactly what you're talking about. And when I say spikes, I mean you are increasing your tonnage, your average intensities by, like, let's say more than 10% in a given week than what you've been prepared for. So if we take a look at your prior training blocks and we say, oh, you were doing volume-based bench work for like 3 or 4 months straight, and then you jumped right into this high-intensity bench program like singles and doubles when you hadn't really been prepared for that. And then you start to feel some of these issues. So we start to like, oh, what's wrong with my forearm? Maybe I'm lacking elbow mobility or shoulder mobility. But we ignore the fact that you had just changed to a stressor that was just beyond what you had been prepared for. So that is priority number 1, 2, and 3. We cannot ignore that. Number 2 is we can distribute loads differently by changing movement or tweaking position. So they may find that they can distribute force a little bit better with altering their elbow position. I'm not going to say what would be better or worse, but some type of change in your normal positioning can distribute forces differently. And you may find changes in your pain perception or sensitivity, your ability to tolerate load. Sometimes that's only a temporary change, though, because we may make a change that actually makes you a little bit less apt to be able to lift the most weight possible. But the goal is that we're trying to break the cycle a little bit. Your body just needs change. A sport like powerlifting is so specific, we tend to run into these overuse movements or injuries because it's the same tissues being loaded the same way over and over and over and over. We're not really wired for that. We're wired for variability. So the more specific you get, your chances of these types of little things happening are probably increased. So if you can just alter position, maybe it's wrist position, maybe it's elbow position, maybe it's grip, to redistribute the forces differently, to give Mother Nature a chance to calm the tissues down. And then you can build back up and reintroduce your normal competition positioning a little bit more slowly. A lot of times that takes care of things without having to like address the local specific tissue. We're thinking like, that's the problem. No, it's just pissed. The problem is the way that you're dosing.
Yeah.
It would be like if I banged my knee against the table and wondered why my kneecap was sore, but I kept doing it over and over and over. Why is this hurting? If I get punched in the face, if I got punched in the face and my jaw was a little tender, I wouldn't wonder why. Like, obvious. It's the same with training. So you need to tweak. You need to figure out your intensity threshold and trigger. And then also pick a position variable that you can manipulate. Not all at once. Don't change your elbow angle and your grip width and your wrist position all at once. One, see if that feels better, or see if that changes your intensity threshold a little bit. And then go from there. From a low bar back squat position, it's kind of the same deal. Like, that's a lot of, if you're not used to that externally rotated shoulder position, that slightly valgus elbow position, but you just start hammering on that with heavy loads and high frequencies, you're going to run into these types of things. But if you dose those things accordingly, if you start going a little wider with your hands at first, and then over the course of multiple sessions, maybe you work yourself in no more than like a finger's width on each side, just graded exposure into these things, your tissues will acclimate. I think probably the biggest issue is people don't give themselves enough time, and their connective tissue doesn't quite turn over and adapt at the same rate as their muscles or their neuromuscular system. So they're getting strong, but they're starting to run into joint type issues because the connective tissue adaptation rate is like 4 times as slow. That's why most of our overuse injuries are like tendons, joint type stuff, ligaments. It's very rare that you pull a muscle from bench, like, ooh, pec, right? But it's still a load greater than capacity issue. But most of them are joint related, and they accrue over time. So that's tier 1 for me is always training load. And then tier 2 is alter some type of position to redistribute forces. Mm-hmm. If that makes any sense.
I think that was an excellent answer. That it gives everyone a nice sort of pathway to being able to manipulate these things themselves, which I think, as we mentioned earlier, is really important. Like having the understanding of where you need to go to first, and not being that guy that goes to, oh well, I'll just stop benching until my elbow stops hurting, and then I go straight back to benching, and it's like, oh, my elbow doesn't hurt anymore. I'll go back to benching. Oh shit, my elbow hurts again.
Exactly, and so that's another thing. You don't want to decrease. You don't want to take the stressor away completely, because then you detrain, and you actually become more susceptible. Like taking time completely off will give Mother Nature a time. The tissues will calm down. Yes, but now you are deconditioned. Your fitness level has actually leveled down. So if you jump right back into the training load that you were prepared for previously, but not so much now, that's a great recipe for a recurrence. So if you do take time completely off, you need to understand that you've got to work back real slow so that you can get that fitness level back. I mentioned those acute spikes, and that's a great example. Also, we're looking for to avoid acute decreases. So if you take time off, that's a spike in the other direction. We want to level those spikes out and start to make our spikes more like this and less like that, because it ends up just being a level line and you never make any progress. Usually we level down. So the biggest paradigm shift is, as an athlete, think about an injury as a training injury, not what's wrong with you, because you had the same anatomy 6 months ago and you didn't have this problem. You were doing just fine. What changed? Oh, the way that you're training. Right. And if you take that approach, you start to think less about you being this fragile thing. It's like you have control to now change up your stressor. Right. And you can manage things, and you just have to be patient enough to allow it to happen. If that makes any sense.
Yeah. And unfortunately, a lot of people aren't patient enough.
No. And if they're not, you're just going to keep spinning your wheels. It's going to be just like what you described. When my forearm was really hurting when I was training hard as hell, it doesn't hurt anymore because I took a lot of time off. But I want to make up for lost time, so I'm going to train hard as hell again. Oh, shit, and there it is. What's wrong with my arm? Let me wrap it up in this thing and, like, roll it and put metal tools and try to scrape away the shitty training paradigm and program. And it just doesn't work like that. You get stuck in cycles.
Yeah. Excellent. Well, I think that's about all we have time for. Dr. Quinn, thank you so much for joining us.
Yeah, absolutely, man. And that's fun. I just want to make a little note because it's funny. I'm experimenting with something. If you saw me chewing gum, you're like, God, that's fucking rude. It's nicotine gum. And so it's something that I've been experimenting with. Instead of coffee, I was drinking way too much coffee.
Is there such a thing though?
Well, for me, it was like making me jittery. It's like,
maybe at that point.
And so there's like some data on nicotine is from.
So I've actually experimented with this as well like a stimulant thing. I occasionally use it for competing and lifting as well. I've done it for training sessions and things like that.
I like the feeling a little bit better as far as like mental clarity and creativity. It obviously can be overdone. Like, I'm not condoning this. Nicotine is an addictive substance.
Oh yeah, for sure. Yeah.
So that's why.
It's a really interesting. It's a really interesting experiment. I've often combined caffeine and nicotine as well, and it works really nicely.
So nice.
Yeah.
Yeah. All right. Well, the benefit is you're always with you, right?
Yeah, it's great quality gum. Like, it doesn't break down at all. You could chew it for 4 hours, and it's still the same consistency.
All right. Okay. Thank you so much.
Yeah, absolutely.
Bye, people.
Thanks, guys.
Thanks for having me on.